The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. The announcement that a Chinese team has altered the genetics of a human embryo for the first time has ignited a wave of controversy around the world. In this week's show, we look at the rapid rise of powerful genome editing procedures that means scientists can start tinkering with DNA, including human DNA, more than ever before. What does it mean for us? Where's the technology going? And where should it stop? In the studio, we have geneticist Robin Lovell-Badge and bioethicist Chris Gingell. Also joining us is Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of The Observer Tech Monthly. So stay tuned. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. A couple of weeks ago, a paper was published in Protein and Cell, an obscure online journal published by China's Ministry of Education. In it, Junjui Huang and colleagues at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou described how in the course of their research into the blood disorder beta thalassemia, they attempted to edit the hemoglobin B gene in 86 human embryos. The news spread fast and attracted condemnation from some quarters, provoking a discussion about whether gene editing should ever be used in human embryos to prevent disease. Joining us in the studio to discuss the subject are Professor Robin Lovell-Badge, a group leader in genetics at the Francis Crick Institute in London, and Christopher Gingell, research fellow in neuroethics at the University of Oxford. Welcome to you both. Robin, before we get into the meat of this, what are these procedures and how do they work?
There are three basic different mechanisms of doing genome editing. They all rely on similar processes. But we're going to focus probably on one of them, which is called CRISPR-Cas9 or CC9 method. They all rely on having a guide, which will take a DNA cutting enzyme or molecular scissors to the specific location you want to edit in the genome. In the case of the CRISPR-Cas9 system, the guide is an RNA molecule, which can be engineered to be complementary to the DNA target you want to reach. So this goes to that location within the genome, part of that RNA is recognized also by this protein, this enzyme that will cut DNA. So essentially the guide brings the molecular scissors to the site you want to edit. It then induces a cut in the DNA. There are two basic mechanisms involved in repairing cut DNA that cells use. One of these just basically sticks the ends together, and this is called a horrible name, non-homology end joining method. But this is a very inaccurate method, so often little mistakes are made in the process. So that can lead to a mutation occurring in the gene, and it often does, where you have little bits of DNA missing or sometimes little bits added. The other mechanism is called homology-directed repair, and that requires a DNA template, which is again has homology to the sequence you want to edit, and you make use of that to engineer in a precise change in DNA sequence. So you take your little piece of DNA which you've modified to have the specific changes you want in it, whether it's a loss of function mutation or maybe to add another sequence in, which is going to make the change you want to make. So whether that could be correcting a mutation or adding another gene in there. That particular method tends to be a little bit less efficient. So the system has a slight bias to use the other not so accurate method when you're doing this process.
So essentially, in a very dumbed down way, you're injecting some enzymes which have been designed essentially to find a particular sequence in the DNA, so GTC, what have you, and the enzymes will go to that point, make a cut, and if you want to take out a section of DNA, you need to make two cuts, and then you need to also inject in, presumably at the same time, your replacement DNA strand. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And how much of the genome is edited in this way? I mean, if you decide to do this procedure to tweak a gene or to correct a gene which might be faulty, I mean, how much of your total DNA are you actually changing? Is it quite small?
You can engineer it so that it's just a single nucleotide, single base pair.
Wow.
Very, very small. Or you can make it much, much bigger. And so you can alter not just one whole gene, but many genes at once, a whole chromosome pieces.
And how specific is this? I mean, is there other difficulties getting it to target just that one particular? I mean, with a single nucleotide, for example, there are lots and lots of, you know, the same.
So it relies on your, in this case, your guide RNA and the specific length of homology that you design into your procedure. So the longer the guide RNA, if you like, the more specificity there is, the less likely it is going to find other sites within the genome. But you're right to ask this question, because it's a very common problem with this technique at the moment, that you can get so-called off-target hits. Mm-hmm. So where the enzyme cuts DNA where it shouldn't. So it's recognizing another gene sequence, maybe not quite as well as your design target, but it's cutting that and introducing a mutation there.
So Robin, when you're talking about nucleotides, you mean what many listeners will know as the DNA letters,
yes.
Correct? And so by homology, you mean to have a sequence of those letters which matches the bit before and after the section you want to take out.
That's exactly right. So if you have something like 18 letters, mm-hmm. so A-C-T-G, 18 of those in a row, that's usually sufficient to recognize just one location in the genome. But these mechanisms aren't perfect, and so a little bit of mismatch can also, as I say, lead to an off-target hit.
Technically, this sounds quite difficult, but how easy is the procedure to do?
This particular method of doing the genome editing is actually relatively trivial. I mean, you've got to worry about a few things, and you can do it either in cells, in culture, so you can add the components to that, or you can do it by directly injecting the RNA that's going to, your guide RNA, and an RNA that's going to encode for the enzyme that's going to cut the DNA. And if you want the homology direct repair, also your little bit of DNA, you just inject all those into the cytoplasm of, in the case of mice, this has been done a lot with a fertilized egg, and the methods are relatively simple and can be very, very efficient.
We're obviously talking about this because of the recent paper to do with the human embryos, but what is this technology being used for at the moment? Presumably it's not just embryo work.
Not at all. So it's been used to do a lot of basic research in using animals like mice to understand the role of specific genes. Because the technique is very efficient, you can use it to inactivate more than one gene at once, and that can be very valuable. So you can get much more faster results. It can also be used on genes which have been difficult to engineer by the old conventional methods, relying on homologous recombination in cell lines, special cell lines, which can take years to get an answer. In the case of using the CRISPR-Cas9, you can get your answer in a few weeks, if you're lucky. So it's far more efficient for basic research in animals. It's been used in human cell lines to, again, ask some questions about genes in cell lines, or set up screens. I think some company has designed a way of mutating every gene in the human genome. So this is being used for drug screens and things. You can look at the effect on cell lines or on the expression of a particular reporter to indicate some activity, whether you're looking for cardiotoxicity or something. Then there are attempts to use these methods for somatic gene therapy. And the well-known,
sorry, Robin, what does that mean?
So,
people
sorry,
might not know somatic.
So somatic is where you are intentionally targeting cell types in the body. So you're not attempting to affect the germline, so in inheritance in any way. So it's just, if you like, a one-off for that individual. So, for example, if you had cystic fibrosis, you could essentially try and correct the gene in the lung. Mm-hmm. Or the one that's been actually undergoing a clinical trial at the moment is for HIV. Mm-hmm. So to try and make individuals who have HIV make some of their cells in their blood resistant to the virus. So any cell in the blood that's now resistant to the virus lives, where cells that aren't die. So actually, because you're targeting stem cell populations, the idea is that you replace the blood system in the individuals now with cells that cannot be infected by HIV.
And they're actually the immune cells, crucially.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In terms of gene therapy, which you're talking about there, this isn't the only technique for gene therapy, though, is it? Or is it the predominant one?
No, there are many other techniques have been worked on for decades, very, very slowly and with not necessarily a huge amount of success. People tend to use viruses mm-hmm. that will infect cells and introduce your therapeutic DNA construct mm-hmm. with the idea of replacing lost gene function, for example. And this has been tried out in things like cystic fibrosis, for example. It's been tried out in actually quite successfully in some cases of very severe combined immune deficiency diseases, sort of baby in a bubble syndromes, mm-hmm. where it's been possible to infect enough blood cells with a gene that will function, which will rescue the child from that disease. These gene editing methods, if you can find a good way of delivering them again, you've still got to overcome that problem. Because they are so efficient, they might work better.
So they're substantially different to normal gene therapy procedures, because this is something I've wondered about, is what is it about CRISPR-Cas9 that is different enough from gene therapy, other gene therapy techniques, that opens up different questions? And we'll come bring Chris in a moment to talk about what those questions are. But
the classic gene therapy approach is you're adding something, you're adding a gene, whereas in this case, you can modify the normal cellular gene, and well, the cellular gene which is defective, and so you can actually try and correct a problem.
And how big a deal is that?
It's probably more precise. In fact, in some of the cases where the gene therapy trials have gone wrong, it's because the foreign DNA you're adding has gone into the wrong place, and it's caused another mutation, which has then compromised the health of the individual.
What is different about this technique or doing it in embryos?
If you're doing it in a very early embryo, of course, the genetic change you're introducing is not going to just be present within that individual. It will also likely affect the sperm or eggs in that individual, such that any children will also inherit that same genetic change. And this has made people nervous. What people are generally talking about is like in the Chinese study, where you're introducing the genome editing constructs into the very, very early embryo, the fertilized egg, because then you know it's present in all of the cells in the early embryo, such that it's going to end up in the resulting gametes, eggs or sperm. But you could introduce this later if you could access, for say, the developing ovaries and testes in the uterus, while the embryo is in the uterus of the mother, then you could try and specifically maybe infect those cells. Or you could even do it in the adult, particularly with men, because you could infect the stem cell population in the testis, so-called spermatogonial stem cells, that gives rise to sperm.
Is it possible to use this technique to engineer an embryo without affecting its own sperm or eggs?
I think very difficult. So unless you're doing it postnatally or in a way that you can target a particular tissue that you want to correct, like lung or kidney or heart or whatever, the only real way to introduce this into an embryo is to do it at the very early stages. And that's before the embryo has set aside the cells that are going to give rise ultimately to eggs or sperm. So you're doing it usually in an embryo, very early stage embryo, in vitro, so you've got to be able to manipulate the embryo. So it's during the process of in vitro fertilization, or just after, that you would manipulate your embryo, and then you have no control of where it goes. So it's going to end up in the germ cells ultimately.
Robin, give me an example of how doing genetic changes to an embryo could help prevent diseases.
Well, generally, you have other techniques which you can use to select an embryo that's going to be free from disease.
And so this is when you'd have two parents
yeah.
who would know that they both carry, or one of them carries, a mutation that could lead to a disease in the child. They would know that already. They'd have that information. So they would know there was a risk of their children having that disease. Yeah. So they would go through IVF and they could have pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to look for it. Yeah.
Yes.
And then select one that was they knew to be free of that mutation to be implanted into the woman.
Yes.
So you can use that to screen for, certainly for the beta thalassemia that these Chinese guys were working on, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So in the UK, that's one of the conditions that you can use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis.
Why then, you know, does this become useful? Why can it be valuable to engineer an embryo?
There may be some fairly rare cases where you couldn't find an embryo that is free from genetic disease. For example, so Huntington's disease, very horrible disease, late onset. So individuals don't develop the symptoms until after they're 40, in their 40s or a bit later. So it is, in fact, theoretically possible to have an individual who is homozygous, so has two copies. Most genes are present in two copies. And so you can have mutations where only a single copy will lead to the disease, and Huntington's is one of those. You could have rare individuals who actually have two mutant copies of that gene, such that all embryos from that individual would be affected by the disease. So that's sort of one type of circumstances where this might be a problem.
Chris, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, look, I think another situation where this technique might be useful is where couples are using IVF and they only produce a very small number of viable embryos, and this does happen sometimes. So in those sort of cases, you're not going to be able to use selection to avoid the disease. So there's another case where they might be really practically useful. Another thing to think about is just say that yourself, that you're the one with sort of beta thalassemia and you've got a family history of it, you know you've got the gene, you know your partner's got the gene, you're really worried and you want to make sure your children avoid it. Now you've got two options to do this. One, you can use selection and that might pass on the gene to your children, therefore your children will be going through the same sort of process, or you can edit it out from your family lineage. And I think, you know, many people find that latter solution much more preferable.
Chris, what do you see as the concerns that scientists have over specifically engineering embryos?
Well, look, I think the really interesting thing about this study and about the reactions to it has been the ethics. So as we've been talking about before, this isn't really technically much different to what's already been happening. People have been using CRISPR to alter the embryos of other species, and they've been using CRISPR to alter other human cell lines. But when we do it in embryos, there's been this great backlash, and especially among members of the scientific community. So I think it's interesting to look at those reasons that are given. Now, Nature published a commentary that outlines some of those reasons. Obviously, there's safety of the embryo. Now, these techniques are very young. As Robin explained, they can make off-target mutations. So if you're going to use these techniques to bring out about a live birth, if you will, there's a risk of widespread damage to the genome and lots of sort of harm in the resulting embryos. And that makes people's nerves, and so it should, you know, any unsafe research.
Because it's not specific enough. It's not accurate enough.
Yeah, that's right. It's not ready for clinical applications.
Okay.
And we don't want to rush it through.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's true of all research. We don't want any research that's going to result in harm to people. And there are guidelines and regulations to avoid sort of unsafe research. Another thing that makes people scared about is altering the germline is going to have these really unintended future, you know, consequences. So we'll select a gene now because we think it's good, but in a few generations, maybe that gene's not good anymore. It's causing problems. And what have we done? It's all in the human all in the human genome now, and it's fixed, so we can't do anything about it.
So that means that we don't know enough about the changes we're making, that we may think this gene is bad. If we change it for a gene that seems to be healthy in the rest of the population, that might seem a good idea today. It may turn out to be a bad idea 10 years hence.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the problem of not knowing what these changes, what effects these changes are going to have in future generations. And the final concern that is really put up is that this is going to put us on a slippery slope to designer babies. So we start doing this for non-disease traits, and then in a few generations, everyone's picking the eye colour, the sort of hair of the baby, making sort of, you know, attractive, good at sports sort of kids. And people are worried about that prospect. And that's why we're getting a bit of backlash here, I think.
So what do you make of these concerns? Are they valid?
I don't think they are.
None of them?
Well, the safety concerns are clearly valid. So, I mean, it would be very unethical to use these technologies now to on any human that is going to be born. It's just not ready. And even if you look at the study that was performed, they showed that. I mean, there was a large number of off-target mutations. The technology is not there. But we do have procedures to make sure unsafe research doesn't thin, but there's already a moratorium on unsafe research. We don't need another one on unsafe gene editing research. With regard to the designer babies, we could use now PGD and IVF to select for tall, smart, attractive babies, but we don't because there are regulations that stop people. And it seems like, why couldn't we just have similar regulations about gene editing where we can only use it in safe cases to avoid diseases?
Robin?
We can use PGD to choose embryos with one or at most two characters. As Chris alluded to earlier, you don't get enough embryos when you do a cycle of in vitro fertilization to be able to choose embryos with more than two particular traits. So yes, you could choose an embryo with blue, you know, with having blue eyes. You could do that. But to choose an embryo that has blue eyes, blonde hair, and is tall, no way. And particularly the question of being tall, because actually there are hundreds of genes involved in height. And so we don't know enough about what's really causing height to be able to do that. If you came to something like intelligence, we really have no clue. So the idea of enhancement in terms of you know, designer babies in that respect, I think is way off. And I don't know of any scientist who would be wanting to do that or trying to do that.
Can I stop you there? You've lost me there, because you're saying about if you have a bunch of embryos from a couple, you wouldn't be able to select one that had a tall, intelligent sports person among them. No. But if you knew those genes, couldn't you engineer them in?
If you knew those genes, because if the CRISPR-type techniques are so efficient, you can actually target multiple genes within a single embryo. So there are people doing this in animals. And so you could, so that these techniques aren't the same as PGD, so you could actually go for more genes at once. Now, that might be an advantage in the case of diseases. So it could be that there is more than one disease gene present within a couple, such that you couldn't use PGD to select for a healthy embryo, but you could, in theory, use these gene editing techniques to correct all the defects. Now, one prospect is as we go to all have our genomes fully sequenced, when we want to have children with our partner, you line up the DNA and say, oh my gosh, we are definitely at risk of having a child who is affected perhaps by multiple different. We all carry, by the way, 100 or 200 mutations, so we're not terribly healthy. You could imagine that you could line up your DNA sequences and say, our children could have these following problems. Why don't we use these methods to correct that?
I have a question here, which is to do with sort of the accessibility of this technique. So it sounds like, you know, potentially it could be used to sort of eradicate certain diseases or have a good health benefit, but surely, is there not a question about who actually would be able to benefit from that? It sounds like the kind of technique that would be available only to those who could afford it, only in countries where it was accessible anyway. How much is this just, you know, a technique for those who've got the cash?
Health economics is a very interesting problem, which is not looked at enough. Generally, if you have someone born with a disease, it costs a huge amount of money to keep that person going. So we just been faced this with mitochondrial replacement in the UK. People were arguing, oh, this is going to be very costly. Actually, no, it's going to cost maybe £10,000-£15,000 per go, whereas to maintain a child with mitochondrial disease probably costs £100,000 a year or something. So it's actually when you cure a disease and you cure it for life, it's often the much cheaper option.
But it still that takes financial outlay in the first place.
Yeah, but then, yes, exactly. There has to be a financial outlay in the first place. And this whole idea of social justice and who could afford it is one that would obviously have to be dealt with.
Yeah, and when we sort of have a good that we think should be equally distributed, that's normally done through sort of political mechanisms, right? I mean, we can subsidise IVF now to let people access it so that they can avoid disease. That seems like similar subsidisation programs could help people access these gene editing.
To give you a practical example, if you could make children resistant to HIV, then you could perhaps use this technique to reduce the burden that populations have for HIV, which would be an economic benefit. And maybe countries in the West would want to help people in, say, South Africa to overcome that burden.
This gets really interesting because it sounded to me before that you were talking about, you had a very Western view of the economics and the situation here, where in rural Africa, someone who is born with a devastating mitochondrial disease may not be costing that country an awful lot of money to keep them alive because they may not be kept alive. And so this point about the haves and have-nots, the accessibility of it, how does that pan out around the world? Will this technique actually be cheap enough? And because it's relatively easy, that there won't be the sort of technological barriers, the cost barriers to it that you get? Or will it end up being something that's exported? And you can imagine, just with the problems we've had in genetically modified crops going around the world, that the idea that you're going to be exporting genetic engineering of children to make them resistant to, say, malaria, to HIV, to Africa, is going to be a total nightmare.
One of the interesting things about new technologies is that we can't always predict how they're going to be distributed. We can't always predict what the effects are going to be on these things like equality. I mean, I think when mobile phones first invented, I think this is only a tool for rich white people and will never, you know, be helpful. But now we find that, you know, they're prevalent in the third world and helping cure inequalities. So we just don't know how these new technologies are going to affect global sort of inequality. But there's at least the potential they could go either way.
What we're talking about is designer babies, though, and it's improvements rather than curing diseases, isn't it?
That's what we've moved on to. So you could say that, you know, if you could make people resistant to a disease, that's an enhancement. So that's not, you know, that's adding something special.
And is that a problem?
Well, you can call vaccines an enhancement too, to give you a cassette or that thing. And most people don't find vaccines problematic. But look, there might be people would find a very large sort of enhancement, say if we're taking radical changes to our sort of physiology or our cognitive abilities, then people might have a problem with that.
You also get into problems where, even with preventing disease, so if you're going to have a procedure that you can engineer an embryo to ensure that that embryo doesn't develop a certain disease, what diseases do you allow it for and what diseases do you not allow it for? Do you say it's okay to use this for a disease that is horrific and life-shortening and puts the person into desperate pain? Or are you going to say there is now never a need for anyone to be born with Down syndrome, and are we then saying that society is better without people with Down syndrome?
That particular example, I think, is going to be hard to deal with because that's a chromosomal disease. So you're not targeting a single gene or even a few genes.
But the milder conditions, it was just an example, but there must be milder conditions where you can say, okay, we can make these, can cure these.
Okay, in the UK, we have the Human Fertilisation and Embryo Authority, who are having to make these sorts of decisions on a regular basis because they're responsible for the regulation of PGD, where they are faced with that choice of whether you restrict the technique just to the most serious diseases or whether you can relax it a bit to allow slightly less serious diseases. So that system in this country is already in place, if you like, to make those judgments.
Yeah, I think you touch on a really important issue, though, some of the sort of collective effects of these technologies. So let's stick with the immune example. One sort of risk is that you've got this gene, say it gives you resistance to HIV, and we let people sort of access this, and everyone picks this gene for their children. But what the gene does, it actually makes you more susceptible to another gene in the future. One of the good things about our sort of populations now is this sort of immunodiversity, where all slightly innately immune to different sort of diseases, and this provides a sort of collective sort of barrier, if you will, to epidemics and things. Once you start letting people pick their immune genes, you might get all these people that are very homogenous, and we might be at a greater risk.
So what Chris is saying is absolutely right. We just, in most cases, really don't understand systems well enough and the role of individual genes well enough. So a lot more basic research would have to be done, I think, before any of us would feel confident to do anything that was going to affect the germline of humans. And so that goes back to, again, in a way, the calls for these moratoriums have been confused somewhat. Some have been saying an outright ban on use in human material. I think that's ridiculous. You need to use these techniques, certainly in human cells in vitro, so in the lab, also on early human embryos in the lab, so not embryos that are allowed to develop any further than 14 days. The reason for doing that is you could understand a lot of basic biology about the early human embryo, the role of specific genes at that stage of embryo development, And because you can make cell lines from those embryos, you could then also ask some questions about the role of specific genes at later points in development. So these techniques are potentially incredibly valuable for basic understanding about mechanisms of how genes work and their role.
Chris, can I ask you a question? One of the things that you touched on earlier was, you know, the various different aspects of squeamishness that we have about this idea of tinkering with nuclear DNA. Do you feel that there's an inherent sort of mindset among scientists that to tinker with nuclear DNA is very different from tinkering, for example, with mitochondrial DNA? Is it sort of like just seen as two very, very different things? Because the mitochondrial DNA transfer sort of legislation was sort of very enthusiastically embraced. Is this just seen as something that's just something completely different?
I think it is seen like that. And I think this might sort of go back to the times where we thought genes were these really powerful determinants of our character and who we are. So, you know, we were our sort of genes kind of thing, and they had this sort of pervasive effect on our character. But, you know, I think the more we learn about from genetic technologies and from genes is that they're not that powerful. They're just sort of, you know, a group of amino acids that we've got in our cells that, you know, give us these certain predispositions and things. But, you know, when we look at their power compared to sort of social determinants of character and health, they're really not that powerful, I think.
So are you arguing that it's okay to do this, or?
Look, I think we have to, you know, just take a step back and look at the... But look, let me give you more examples. I mean, we can do things that aren't genetic that can, you know, have effects on our biology and effects that sort of, you know, the effects that go through generations. So these are sort of epigenetic changes that they're sort of learning more about. So one recent study, apparently if you smoke when you're a teenager... as a man, you can then pass on sort of these epigenetic changes to your children that increases their risk of asthma. So these things are happening all the sort of time. I don't think it's fair to single out this gene editing as this very special sort of case where it's, you know, got these really, you know, long-term effects that we don't know about. This is true of lots of things that we do.
But the thing is, everyone knows that smoking's irresponsible. And if I smoke as a teenager, I know I'm being irresponsible, but we expect scientists and doctors to be responsible and to do no harm.
I agree, yeah. I'm just saying that, you know, when you talk about these risks of gene editing, you know...
But we can't say it's okay to have some risks because smoking, like, is dangerous, so we can allow some dangerous stuff to happen.
Well, so another one is, so you know, we're talking about making modifications to the germline. Delaying paternity makes modifications to the germline. We know that older fathers pass on more random germline mutations to their children than younger fathers, okay? We don't take this as a good enough excuse to limit limit paternity just to young, virile men. You know, we accept these risks as something that might happen and, you know, not that important. I just think sometimes when people think about gene editing, it gets this sort of, oh, there are these things that are bad about it, but these are, you know, these are general risks that are that apply to lots of things.
I think it's often you get this knee-jerk reaction when these sorts of techniques are proposed and everyone goes, ah, help, no, we can't possibly do this. What's important is that you have, whenever you're considering using any of these techniques, that it's assessed properly. So you have to have a very good regulatory system. The UK is lucky that we have such a system. Many other countries don't. And I think that's the bigger issue. Countries should be pulling their socks up and they should be thinking about this in a way. You need to consider every case separately because, say, in the majority of cases, we won't understand a gene well enough. But if you are correcting Huntington's disease gene, that's probably okay because we do know what causes the disease. And if you can correct that, that would be okay.
If there is a public reluctance to support this kind of work, doesn't that tell you something in as much as it may not be just uninformed? I'm sure it will be uninformed. Who of us outside of genetics isn't uninformed about this? But doesn't it tell you something about maybe the way people see their society and the identity of the society and all that sort of thing, that maybe people's intuitions, people's knee-jerk reactions, their sort of gut reaction to something like this actually tells you what people in a society are happy with and what they want?
It tells you what they want, but it doesn't mean they're necessarily right, okay?
You could come in with your sort of moral, your cold moral logic and say, well, of course we should allow this sort of stuff, but maybe the people not liking it have are reflecting well, something about was, society, right?
Sure, but I think there was public uproar about lots of technologies that are now accepted. So I think when IVF came along, there was all this uproar about test tube babies not being natural at having these, you know, unpredictable effects on future generations. But now it's a very accepted common technology that no one has that reaction about. I mean,
do you have the feeling that this is basically inevitable, that scientific enthusiasm and that kind of lure of that challenge and that side of things basically means that eventually, regardless of initial public opinion, scientists will get their way and there will be this research? Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, look, I just think when you look at the potential of this technology to cure genetic diseases, to make us all live longer, healthier lives, the appeal of that is going to win over. And, you know, we don't know when it will be where these technologies are used. You know, they've only been, gene editing techniques have only been around for sort of 5 years or so. In 20 years, in 30 years, if they're really precise, I think people will start to accept them as tools that can make us live better lives.
But also, it's not for scientists to decide when these techniques are going to be applied. That's got to be for society to decide. So you have
bioethicists.
specifically bioethicists. No, it's got to be for society as a whole to make those decisions. So it requires. We've got to engage the public in these. If scientists really want to push something forward, you have to go through this process of really making sure that the public understand what you want to do it and why, what are the problems, you know, if there are any. So we've just, as you know, in this country, been through this whole process of changing the legislation, which now permits mitochondrial donation or placement, so you can avoid having children with serious mitochondrial disease. The prequel to all of the vote in both houses of parliament was many years of public engagement and trying to understand all the science, the social aspects, the ethics. A huge amount of work went for that one, if you like, type of method. So I think the same has to happen. So we wouldn't, you know, scientists certainly in this country aren't going to go ahead and try and get babies with a germline modification. We're not. It's illegal to start with. And we wouldn't do it because we would only do it if we felt the public wanted it. I think the concern is that there are going to be some people with perhaps large egos in other parts of the world who want to be the first, whether they're scientists or clinicians or, you know, parents or whatever. They want to be the first to do this. And I think that's silly. You shouldn't do these sorts of things for vanity. They should be done for good.
Robin Lovell-Badge there with Chris Gingell.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades.
It's clearly the most important story that we could be thinking about, and yet you scan the daily newspapers and it's almost absent.
A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change.
Bill's simple proposition and his urgently was, this stuff has to be kept in the ground. It cannot be dug up.
So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care?
That's the challenge. What can you do that will force them to sit up and pay attention?
The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
Nicola, let's take a look at the Observer's Tech Monthly out this Sunday. It's a special. What on?
This month, we are devoting the entire feature section of the issue to climate change. We have a nationwide poll looking at public attitudes towards climate change, and we have interviews from those who are leading the campaign to tackle climate change, including diplomat Kofi Annan, model and campaigner Lily Cole, primatologist Jane Goodall, climate scientist Heidi Cullen, and actor David Harwood. We also check in with climate scientist Tamsin Edwards, who is explaining what the hot topic of debate is in climate science at the moment. And she guides us through the views of a new kind of contrarian called the lukewarmers, and why their views are actually being listened to by the scientific community. We also take a look at the impact of a warming world on Antarctic glaciers. Our science editor, Robin McKee, has been talking to scientists surveying the Pine Island Glacier in Antarctica, and they're doing work to explore exactly why these glaciers are retreating at such a rate.
I like the sound of this public poll, Nicola. Do you have anything in that that tells you anything about the society's willingness to do anything about climate change, its willingness to accept that it's an issue?
I think, yes, I mean, certainly. And the outcome is actually quite positive. So 81% of people we polled believe that global climate change is happening. And 76% believe that that's largely down to man-made emissions. So that's a very positive positive result. In terms of what they're willing to do about it, well, 69% believe that the individual action can have an impact on reversing climate change. And when it comes to what people would be willing to do, 51% say that they'd be willing to reduce the amount that they're using their car to make small journeys. Perhaps I found most interesting is that 40% of those we surveyed said that they would be willing to reduce the amount of meat that they eat, which, you know, given the impact of the livestock industry on global greenhouse gas emissions, which is considerable, that's a fairly interesting stat to come out from there, that people are willing to make a change to their diet, they are willing to take personal action on this.
And that's all in Tech Monthly out this Sunday. That's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to our guests. From me and all the science team, thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.